Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters-Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome to the Lift Every Voice Book Club, where I am delighted, as always, to be joined by my conversation partner, Claudia Love Meyer. And this month, we are really excited to have Makoto Fujimura with us, an amazing artist and also a beautiful author of this wonderful book that we're going to be discussing. A little bit of a glare there, so, but Art and Faith, The Theology of Making, you can sort of see the cover there. So Makoto is a leading contemporary artist whose process-driven, refractive, slow art has been described by David Brooks of New York Times as a small rebellion against the quickening of time. I love that image of slow art. He graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree from Bucknell University and then studied in a traditional Japanese painting doctorate program for several years at Tokyo University of the Arts with several notable artists. So welcome, Mako, and it's wonderful to have you with us. And I wonder if you could start us off by just saying a little bit more, filling out your background a little bit more as an artist.
Yeah, great to be here. And I was born in Boston. My father is a scientist and we traveled around. So I was in Boston, then Sweden, and then Japan for many years. And then I came back to the United States when I was in middle school in New Jersey and high school. And I went to Bucknell University after that. And after graduation, I decided I really needed to go back to Japan and re-examine my roots, and because it was coming up in my paintings, whether I liked it or not. So I wanted to go back. Particularly, I was intrigued by 16th and 17th century art, and so I fortunate to receive this national scholarship, ended up being in Japan for 6.5 years. And at that point, we moved back to the United States, ended up in New York City. And right now I'm in Princeton, New Jersey. Moved out here about 10 years ago, a dozen years ago. but I'm here in my studio, converted horse barn, and working away. My writings flow out of my art and studio practice. I've always felt writing was very important for what I do as an artist. And so I didn't think I would be an author, but ended up writing several books. And Art Plus Faith is really my life work of thinking about biblical realities of discovering this creator God and through Christ's work, and then being invited into new creation. So I wrote a manuscript 3 times as long as a book, and my editor did a fine job of making it readable. So the book came out last year, and I was really intrigued by people's responses. It's been an amazing journey. So
wonderful. Well, you mentioned new creations. I thought maybe we could start there. Yeah. Because you talk about, you know, how, well, I love this image that God was singing creation into being, even in Eden. And then, you know, the whole idea of the Christian narrative is all about the newness and the new beginnings, and that we're given the imagination as the as mm-hmm. the spark or the catalyst for that. Mm-hmm. So can you say more about that, mm-hmm. the role yeah. of the imagination and, you know,
yeah,
how we co-create that newness?
Yeah, so, you know, Jewish theologians notably say that when God spoke, it wasn't the word in Hebrew is not just like speaking, it is literally dancing and singing. It's exuberance and abundance of creation. And as I note in the book, there's a sense in which God did not need to do that. It's just a pure gift, and out of love, God created. And so you wonder why it is that we don't celebrate that, especially in the church. When we think about religion, we tend to think about rules, and we tend to think about institutions and maybe even a political power base, but we don't think about this God who exuberantly is dancing, so joyful in creation and created things that are not necessary, you know. And that sense of abundance and that sense of grace and gift is exactly what I experience in the studio. The artists make things that are not necessary to survival, and yet many will say that it is essential to humanity. And so it seems to me that biblical principle, biblical way of describing this creator God it points certainly to our creative imaginations to be harnessed in a way that we don't talk about in the church that much. When you think about why the gap between creative imagination, what I call sanctified imagination, and how the gospel is preached or how the institutional church is not able to teach our children how to sanctify the imagination. There are many reasons for this gap, but artists and writers often fall in the gap. And we experience push and pull from both sides, both perhaps from the church and from the world. And so I wrote this book, hopefully to make sense of that and to give some theological bedrock, very orthodox, actually, theology, but in a way that it's applied, since I focus on new creation as much as I focus on redemption. Both are necessary, but to recover from the fall. But God has given us so much more than just to fix the world. God is inviting us into that dance, into that co-creation, amazingly, miraculously, and incredibly. So we get to partake in this new creation. And in fact, God seems to not want to do anything until we create. So there's kind of a motivation to that.
It's a lovely image of like a partnership in the dance. And when you were just speaking about like that exuberance and it reminded me of a friend of mine who's a dancer, and she proclaims that story of creation. And when it comes to, you know, God said, this is good. Like she's so expressive about it. And whenever I hear her, I think, why do our churches, we don't have, you know, the person proclaiming the gospel is usually so kind of flat, you know. There's not that exuberance of it. So anyway, it was
be a dance, right?
Yeah, exactly. I love it.
I needed this book when a 16-year-old preacher / writer / artist, but mostly preacher, because I wasn't supposed to do those other things. But we'll get back to that.
Yeah.
In the first chapter, The Sacred Art of Creating, even on page one, you say that the journey of an artist begins at conception. Could you elaborate on that? And what does it look like to be an artist if we're not visual or literary or entertainment artists?
Yeah. I think I'm quoting or thinking about at least Psalm 139, you know, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. We are created toward new creation. And then when we come into this world, we don't fully understand that. We are birthed into a fallen world and broken world. And, you know, it seems like survival is the only way that we can learn to understand our world. But when you encounter the Bible, this creator God is the abundance of creation is everywhere in the Bible, despite of what you see, the wasteland in front of you, the devastation of the cities in front of you, Babylonian existence. So all of that is there. And certainly in Jesus' time, people did not assume, to have assurance of any kind when it comes to survival. And yet here's Jesus, you know, standing on the hills of Galilee, saying, pay attention to that world of abundance that God has created you in front of you, and consider the lilies of the field, look at the birds of the air. And I note in the book that considering the birds in the Jordan Basin means to be underneath millions of birds migrating from Mozambique to Europe every year. It is the most abundant place of migration in the world. And so Jesus wasn't looking, you know, saying, look at these sparrows, only there are millions of birds flying over you. See how God has created this world in abundance. And if God cares for those birds, well, how much more would God be in, have you in mind in going through what you're going through today? And that is a trigger for me as an artist because it reminds me, first of all, how I should create, and anybody should create, you know, not just me as a professional artist, but any human being standing on the hills or faced with devastation. We need to understand that God is still the God of abundance. Yes, we need to do what we need to do to survive. But if that is the only thing that we do and teach our children to be Darwinian survivors, then we're missing the entirety of what God has created. And despite everything that we face, we see there are burning bushes everywhere. There are miracles all around us. And all of us are invited into that mystery of creation. And what artists ought to do is help point the way, right? Art, music, theater, poetry, dance should point into that mystery and the power of that mystery. And all of us can partake in that journey toward new creation.
That's so beautiful. You know, what I'm seeing playing out in American Christianity about God's abundance, it doesn't sound like what you just described.
Scarcity instead.
It's a whole different view of what abundance is as like money and power rather than all of these beautiful, simple things that belong, you know, to all of us. Earlier today, I was on a podcast from writing prompts to the page. And the last question I was asked was, well, where can writers find prompts? And I said, you can find a prompt in a tree to write about. You can find a prompt in the clouds. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's easier to think of something that is not these beautiful, lavish things that are very extra God has given to us. So I love that.
Yeah, and you know, culture wars is a mechanism to pinpoint the scarcity, even if scarcity is a fantasy. Right. So you create fear, and media works this way to amplify that, you know, we enemies are coming to get us kind of a thing. When really we should read Matthew 6 and keep preaching to our hearts that that's not the case. You know, God is in control. We don't have to be afraid. And the whole point of Jesus arriving on the side of eternity is that there is hope for something beyond this Darwinian scarcity model that leads to culture wars. You know, many people fight that battle thinking that that's the only way. But really the gospel speaks of another path, which is the world of extravagance and abundance that is already present in the world, embedded in the world and embedded in us, if we pay attention to that.
You know, you were saying a little bit earlier how art is not necessary, but it is essential.
Yeah.
And you do talk a few places in the book about this. And in one of the, on page 34, you talk about we need music and theater not just for entertainment, but as a proven way to survive our traumas, even in the most severe trials, such as the Nazi concentration camps. Art literally sees us through beauty in the hardest, darkest hours. And I loved that. I loved your whole development of that idea, because I've always loved Dostoevsky's quote about beauty will save the world, because I know in dark hours for myself that art, you know, a song has reached towards me or a poem has reached toward me. We live in really dark times right now. I think that's probably always true, but it feels really dark through all different ways, both collectively and personally. So how do you see that essential nature of art? I mean, you've spoken, of course, to the abundance and the grace, but how do we take that in when we're in that dark place, and how does that nourish and sustain us?
You know, one way to acknowledge that is to say, yes, it is dark. And even that Dostoevsky quote, beauty will save the world, is a question mark. It's one of the characters asking, almost in jest, you know, can beauty save the world? You know, but it's a profound question, because if you are, you know, caught up in this dictatorial darkness of not knowing whether human freedom can be sustained in the imprisoned sense of darkness, that question can trigger so many thoughts. You know, so Messiaen composing in the Nazi concentration camp, Quartets for the End of the World, right? And what does that do? Or T.S. Eliot writing four quartets, you know, still traumatized by being an air warden in London, and imagining London, entire London going down, the London Bridge being destroyed and so forth. You know, what can imagination do to counter the real fears, right? The real sense of doom in front of us. You know, I'm a survivor of 9/11. I lived and worked in Ground Zero. My children are Ground Zero children. They had to grow up during those dark days after 9/11. And so I know a little bit about darkness and facing Ground Zero every day. Coming home meant coming home to Ground Zero. So that sense of trauma and the many, many, you know, results of the darkness in my life compounded over the years, even after 20 years, you know, I still discover new hairline fractures, you know, in my life. But nevertheless, the question, the proper question to ask is can beauty save the world? And the answer to that is an open-ended question. It's for all of us to answer that question. It's to choose to wake up every day in your Ground Zero and my Ground Zero, and choose to create into that vacant space in the to the wasteland, and choose to believe that the songs of creation is still abounding, and to look for language which doesn't exist really in the world. The world is Darwinian. World is full of scarcity language of violence and transgression and so forth. But choose to believe that somehow you can find that still point of the turning world, as Eliot found, and to not only find that, but to develop an entire cohesive poem called Four Quartets that invoke, you know, the music into the darkness, into your own heart, first of all, but to stay with it until it becomes something concrete, to do the hard work of a poet to create a incredible overlaps and, you know, tapestry of meanings through words, and create new expressions and create new ways of looking at the wasteland in front of you. And that process is what we are called to as artists and writers and any creative activity. And it's hard work. It's actually an impossible task to me, unless you are able to tap into the spirit's unction to allow us to discover a new frontier, new language, new vista, that many people cannot see. Right, so we would seem odd, if we, you know, enigmatic, odd, but that is nevertheless our call, and it's important to have a group like this, right, to be able to ask questions that perhaps you don't want to ask out there in the church, but to come together, knowing that it's a safe place to develop the language that you are trying to develop in order to speak about hope and speak about faith in a new way.
I love that nuance of holding the question, and as opposed to a declaratory statement, and showing up each day to speak into that open space so that the darkness brings us. Yeah, thank you for that. Beautiful.
I think it would be a good time to talk about Kintsugi. Christine and I both have a question about it. So could you kindly tell us more about that? And my question is that you say trauma mended becomes something new. I would like for you to elaborate on that. And Christine will have a question.
Kintsugi is a vulnerable, venerable Japanese tradition, flows out of tea in 16th to 17th century Japan. And I happened to come across it while I was studying in Japan. And recently it's become very popular in America as well. You know, you have Kylo Ren's helmet in Star Wars, Kintsugi, and so forth. And it's a fantastic way of addressing what we have been talking about new creation. And when the very important tea ware breaks, Japan has many earthquakes, and they don't fix it. They often will hold on to the fragment. The more valuable the bowl, the more they wait to try to mend it. And oftentimes it's passed on to several generations before it is given to a Japan lacquer master who will mend it, not fix, but mend it to make new, using gold onto the fractured areas to make a new design out of them. So the resulting Kintsugi bowl is far more valuable than even the original, as valuable as that may have been. And this is just absolutely a beautiful way of illustrating what happens after the resurrection. Jesus comes back not just as a glorified human being, but he comes back as a wounded glorified human being, which is a very significant detail. And it is through his wounds that we are healed. And that means that to Jesus in the new creation, which flows out of his wounds, is very much at the heart of the gospel. It is part of what makes us and our wounds invaluable for new creation. When I think about that in my life, and I can show you many wounds, but in order to get from a place of trauma and place of suffering, to be able to see my brokenness as beautiful, and that's what Kintsugi Master will do, is before mending the bowl, he or she will look at it for a long time, behold it, until that shape of the brokenness becomes absolutely beautiful and actually complete in itself. And then you can start to mend, because then some newness will take over in how you mend and how you design with gold and lacquer. And that is exactly what God does with us. Many times we, the church, try to fix somebody. We have all these programs. And those are not bad things, but they kind of miss this point of valuing our journey, valuing our wounds. And the Bible does not glorify brokenness at the same time, but this is a mystery of how we need to understand that God's love flows through our wounds into the new creation as much as Jesus's wounds have healed us, right? So that's the beginning of a new journey that the church, body of Christ, is on. The bride of Christ is part of this new journey toward new creation. And as I said, God somehow, incredibly, does not act until we choose to act in faith. So every single sentence that we write in faith, every painting that I do, every time somebody makes a meal for the homeless, those simple acts, ordinary acts, can be amplified by this God of grace to create this new creation. We don't understand it fully, but this is the gospel. And this is what Kintsugi points to, is something that becomes more valuable than, when the valuable vessel broke. And then the work, that's the beginning of our journey.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Claudia, finish your thought.
I was just going to say, and I was picturing this bowl that I have. My vessel broke in October when my son passed away. One of my grief sisters, I went to a grief support group, and one of my grief sisters gave me a Kintsugi bowl. And in looking at it, I can see myself in it, in such a personal way, because I'm not the same vessel that I was, 9 months ago. But there has been beauty that has come out of it. I mean, I would rather be the other, the other bowl. But because I am not, there is still beauty and redemption in that suffering. And I think everybody should buy a piece of art like that, because it really is a mirror of our human experience.
Brought a authentic Kintsugi bowl. It was a Korean bowl, broke, used in Japan in high tea, broke and mended, I think a century later, or it couldn't be that much, 300 years later or whatever. families of that tea master kept it. And I brought it to Columbine High School. And I didn't know what to expect. I had the families of victims who lost their children. And one of the parents said, you know, I can feel the trauma in this bowl. And when I said to them that I explained to them, this was the pieces were held sacred for several generations before they even began to mend. And I know that some traumas we never get over. I know that it's like generational work. The hope that we have perhaps is understanding that the next generation will understand our trauma and carry that trauma in their lives in order that the generation after that can begin to mend. And to me, you know, it was a obviously a profound experience. It was the 20th commemoration of the mass shooting. And for these parents to, you know, to gather, right, to be able to stay as a community of the wounded, of the people who suffered tremendous, unimaginable losses. But to be able to say, we can never move on from this, but we can begin a new journey, you know. And I think for many of us who are survivors, we kind of have struggled to understand, you know, that we can't move on from it, right? And that takes time. And but Kintsugi reminds us that there is this journey that perhaps the next generation and generation beyond can be on because of the pain that we experienced.
I love the multi-generational perspective on that suffering. It makes a lot of sense. And I was so blown away in the book when I really thought about the fact that the Kintsugi bowl is more valuable after it's broken and repaired than before. And you talk about how, you know, our wounds matter to God and how what we do what we do on this side of eternity connects to the other side. And I wonder if you could just break that open a little bit more, because that's, I mean, obviously it's a mystery, but.
Yeah, N.T. Wright, who wrote the foreword to this book, his theology is so exquisite because he talks about the new creation breaking in through mercy and beauty and evangelism and so forth. And I when I read some of his writings, you know, I began to think as an artist, oh, so it does matter. You know, what I do quietly in a studio that no one may see, you know, sometimes art can be seen in a public space, but a lot of times we know that as artists and writers, a lot of our efforts remain invisible to the world, and it should. But to know and believe that what I do in faith can be sanctified and purified by the Holy Spirit, And somehow that is going to ignite a whole new movement of how God will create into the new creation. You know, there's a wonderful little story by J.R.R. Tolkien called Leap by Niggle. And the story begins, there was a little man named Niggle who had a long journey to make. And it's a wonderful little short story that he wrote when he was having a writer's block. And he ended up writing the story about this little man who was an artist and who was commissioned to do a painting. And he could not finish his painting, but he only paints one leaf. And I want to spoil the ending, but you know, he goes in, it's a short story, so you can read it in one sitting, but he goes on a long journey on a train, and on the other side, which is new creation, that one leaf that he painted becomes an entire tree, and that tree becomes an entire forest, and there's a whole new world waiting for him, right? Because he painted that leaf. If he did not, that would not exist. And J.R.R. Tolkien, after having wrote that, finished his trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. So this was a breakthrough for him to think that, you know, many times we're writing this massive piece maybe, and we think we'll never be able to finish it. It's too much. But maybe what God is asking us to do is paint one leaf and paint it well in faith. And God is going to do the rest, you know. And sometimes we're fortunate on this side of eternity to complete that, but if not, it's the other side. And to me, that made such a huge difference in my outlook of whatever my definition of success may be. First of all, the greatest success is being able to define your own success. And so if you can do that, then may our success be being faithful to painting that one leaf, and let God take care of the rest. And to me, that opens up a whole new way of thinking about my journey as an artist. And part of the reason why I wrote this book is because I know that all of us struggle with, you know, having some sense of completion in our work. And you know, we think, well, no one's going to read this, so no one's going to see this. But to God, it matters, right? What we do, even if nobody sees it. And so I think it's a reminder to us that, you know, anything done in faith, even if it disappears into the darkness of ground zero, is going to remain. God is not going to waste that. And that is one of the greatest things that we can ever know in our faith. When we find Christ, we are redeemed, but that's only the beginning of our journey. And everything we do after that can become part of the new creation.
I think that's going to be a huge comfort to many people who are part of our community who would identify as creatives. And I know for myself too, you know, even though I'm a writer and I publish a lot of my writing, but so much, you know, so many times you write things and you think, who's going to see this? But it's not, you know, it comes so much, I think, from that kind of capitalist productive mindset where you do something for the, you know, the ultimate goal of making a living or making a sale or something like that, that it's only valuable there. And what you're saying is this beautiful inverse of that, you know, that God actually takes it in and will make something far bigger than we could even imagine out of it, no matter what it is.
Yeah, I mean, J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, his publisher didn't want to publish the trilogy. He said, no one's going to read this, you know, that's it. the fantasy genre didn't exist. Yeah. He created it, right? So many times, you know, what we do in faith, you know, publishers will not understand that. Yeah. And the world may not take time to understand that, just like Kintsugi being passed on several generations. You know, we're speaking into the void and into the cracks maybe, and that might take time, but to know for sure, assurance of, you know, the substance of things hoped for, right, the evidence of things unseen, being part of our faith, that we can somehow craft something that is enduring, if we stay true to ourselves and not worry about necessarily the transactional part or how to please a marketplace or to write, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing that. It's just that it limits our capacity to grow, to sanctify imagination, to have faith, to fly into the new creation, because that takes risk. And we really, the world is not going to have a paradigm for that.
That this reminds me of what you wrote about utilitarian pragmatism in our places of worship. That leave artists struggling. Like, well, your value is how you gonna serve the spectacle here? How are you gonna do that? And you said that there's no space for an artist to be fully an artist and fully human. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I think the arts are fundamentally part of God's heart for creation, right? The creation is gratuitous. It is act of love rather than an act of necessity. It's not transactional, at all. God doesn't need anything, right, from us. So we are what one writer calls, our anthropology is eccentric. We're not central to God's being, obviously. We believe that, but we act as if we're central. Like we determine what God is saying in the world, right? And artists are kind of these border stalkers who kind of roam in the borderlands. And we know that the tribal language doesn't satisfy the whole. And there are many other tribes that we can visit and get to know, and languages that we can learn. And the beauty of our journey is that we can go back to our tribes and tell them what we saw, this amazing reality. And by the way, that's the borderlands is where the spirit roams and where Jesus takes us to. So many times in the church, in an institutional church, we don't have a place for this. I always joke that Sunday school should be taking a whole bunch of teenage sheeps, trying to jump over the fence and leading them out into the good pasture. John 10, right? Jesus does that, right? To that's his picture of the church. He's not, keeping them with high walls and entrapped in the tribal zone to protect them from harm. He actually literally takes us into wilderness where there are danger out there, storms and wolves. So he says to go in twos, but then the good shepherd is going to bring them back into the tribal realm. And the safety of that is important. So art is kind of this journey toward the borderlands, discovering new things, hopefully in twos, and then bring them back into the tribal areas so that we have a better understanding of the world. We can speak multiple languages, we can translate, we can begin to understand that the world is more complex than our tribal language will allow us to express. And that journey is critical for sanctifying our imagination toward a new creation, because new creation cannot, by definition, be gleaned into if we don't take that risk, and then walk in the borders and understand that we can get lost in that. And I always think I'm that last, one sheep that gets lost. And the good shepherd promises to come and get me. And he did many times. So I understand both the propensity of an artist type to, first of all, be so eager to get out, and be lost. When they don't know the danger of what that means. And also the tribal leaders, right, who wants to protect the young, especially the young sheep, and is holding them back because they're afraid of losing them. Yes, those two things are real, but the good shepherd is the one that stands in the gap and promises that all will be well if you listen to his voice. So if we can do that collectively, and that's really key to me, is that, you know, not just those who can articulate, writers and artists and singers and, you know, musicians and theater folks, but those who are in entrepreneurial businesses and accounting and plumbers, you know, we all need to go out there together to experience that.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I want to touch on what you talk about in terms of the art of waiting, because I know it's very central to the kind of art that you do, and you might tell us a little bit about that art process and what happens in the waiting. How is that central to your creative process and being an artist in general?
You're asking that. This little piece here, it has over 100 layers. And so many times I layer and layer before I even start. And to me, that act of waiting for layers to dry, it's very important. It slows me down, but it's also where a lot of, you know, thoughts come in. It's in the margins, right? When we have enough space in between thoughts, that generates more thoughts. you know, when we go for a walk or we're taking a shower and some brain dump happens, that's because there are margin spaces, and we don't create enough margin spaces for ourselves, for our communities. Like all the church programming is great, but if you don't create margin spaces, nothing new is going to happen. You know, you can implement things that are instrumental and utilitarian, but you cannot generate generative thinking into the world as a church. So that is, to me, critical part of, you know, of the church, really. Church ought to be a place where people come in and they can just be themselves, you know, and it's a place of feasting. It's a place of safety and comfort, certainly, but it's also a place where you are given wings, you're given new things to dream. It's where, you know, Dr. King's "I Have a Dream" speech becomes a reality for everyone. Everybody should have that speech, you know, because of the church, right? The reality is we have all sorts of problems, you know, racism and brokenness, but the church ought to be a place where we can truly imagine a world where all of us are able to not only dwell together, but to thrive together. And that kind of, you know, where is that church, right? You know, and you know, to ask that, you know, is like asking, you know, can beauty save the world? You know, can the gospel save the world? We need to be asking that honestly and together. And artists are the ones that probably can articulate some of what the church is wrestling with better than, you know, institutional side of the church.
Yeah, I worked for a couple of parishes years ago, and my feeling was always like the amount of programming that they would try and cram in. And I just thought, let's get busier, was just sort of the mantra, the unspoken mantra. And I love this idea. Yeah, I often thought, like, what if we just took a year off from programming entirely and just invited people into empty space? And, you know, of course, the pastor was just like horrified at the thought. You know,
actually, the pandemic kind of did that, right?
And
most of us, most churches want to get back. Right? But I think it's actually more important to keep what has been lost and to grieve, certainly, but also to understand that maybe we need that margin space. Maybe we need to be quarantined in a sense, intentionally. right? Yeah. To, you know, what happened during the Black Plague, right? In 1400s is, you know, Frangelico painted, right? Mm. So the Shakespeare wrote and created theater outside of London because he couldn't build one inside of London because of the Black Plague, right? So many things were happening. The artists were thinking and trying to figure it out. And they said, well, this is gonna last a while. You know, that's the three generations. And so they instead of like just stopping, you know, to dream, they started to dream inside of that quarantine reality. And what happened? The Renaissance happened. So something can happen if we honor that silence and slowing down and intentional, you know, grounding ourselves in what is true, good, and beautiful. And if we can do that as a community, you know, perhaps we don't need to have all these programming as good as they are.
Yeah.
But they will be only good as if we had the time to pause and reflect and to be a true community, community that is unconditional, you know, not just because you can perform well on stage or, you know, you can preach well, or you can, no, everyone has something invaluable to give to the new creation. Let's find out what that is.
I love that. Well, we're almost at the end of our time. So Claudia, do you have one more question to round this out?
Yeah. I love what you were just saying about the margins and that downtime. Could you give our community some way that we can integrate that kind of margin into our lives and into our creative practices?
Yeah. So we started this Academy Kintsugi in order to do that, to help people understand. And we have certified trainers now, over 23, I think, all over the country. And they're basically sent out to create cultural care community spaces where we can do that. One little practice that I used to practice, I should probably go back, is every Saturday I mark in my calendar 2 hours to waste time. I literally put it in there, you know, and I just think about, okay, how can I waste time with my kids? How can I waste time with my friends? And I'll call up my friends. I was in New York City at the time. And I say, hey, you know, are you free 2 o'clock on Saturday? And they say, yeah, let's get together. And they say, okay, what is it about? And I said, I just want to waste time with you. And I'm telling you, to this day, many of the things, conversations that I remember happened those 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Things that I will never forget with my kids or, you know, my friends, you know, it's amazing. And I think about all those projects that I was working on, all the things, good things that I had in my calendar, right? I don't remember any of those. Like I did a lot, right? But business, art, ministry, but I don't seem to, like, my brain doesn't recall, but those moments when I had, you know, through baseball with my son and hustling, you know, the fields and the conversation I had with my friends, artist friends who are struggling, or those things I remember. And they're probably more constructive, you know, if you want to use a utilitarian word, for our writings and our art than anything that we can. It's a fuel for our soul that continues to allow me to understand, what am I writing towards, or what am I painting into, right?
Mm.
And it's if anything, you want that, whatever is enduring, to be given to the world, so that when they see my work, when they read your writings, that they pause and say, wow, you know, there's so much more than, you know, resume building, that I sense something here. I can't articulate it, but these words help me to get there. you know, and I call that Lazarus culture, because Lazarus in John 11, John 12 didn't do anything except get sick, die, and be resurrected. He doesn't have a line. You know, this play, and yet he's the central, he's the most important. And you know, John 12, first line, he is sitting, reclining at the table of the Lord, right? Because he knows he was, you know, like everybody's out to get him because he's causing so much, you know, commotion. And he's like, I was dead, you know. And I heard the voice of God, and here I am. As long as I'm with this guy, Jesus, I'm just going to be fine. You know. And I wonder, right, because we know more about the resurrection than Lazarus did then, right, for his temporary resurrection. We know more about Jesus' resurrection, permanent resurrection, how he would, you know, be glorified. So why aren't we relaxed, sitting at the table? Yeah. You know, being able to enjoy Jesus' presence in our lives. And out of that abundance, right, will come something genuine, something enduring in our writings, in our lives. And if that's, you know, that's what if the whole entire church, whole entire culture did that? Mm-hmm. You know, would we have a culture that is more loving, that is more caring, that you know, that is good and true and beautiful? And I wonder about that. So I you know, that's my goal, is to hopefully everything that I do will lead to that.
That is a beautiful way to wrap up this wonderful conversation. This book is amazing. If you have any interest in Art and Faith, then you should definitely read Art and Faith, A Theology of Making. Thank you, Marco. It's been such a real treat and pleasure
I enjoyed speaking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you.